This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday and Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here with an update from Monticello. It's the 55th anniversary of Woodstock. Dr. Neil Hitch from the Bethel Woods Museum is here to reflect on the unforgettable summer of 1969 when 500,000 people gathered on a dairy farm in Bethel down the road for a weekend of legendary performances. We'll revisit the magic of Woodstock and its lasting impact on music, culture, and the quest for social change. Take me out to the ball game in the 1800s. The Zane Grey Vintage Baseball Game is next Saturday. We talk to the Mountain Athletic Club and the Elizabeth Resolutes about the exhibition, plus Japanese artist and activist Yasuo Tanaka and Harmony in the Woods with the String Queens. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Vice President Harris is expected to unveil her plan for the U.S. economy today during a campaign event in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's called for an increase in the child tax credit up to $6,000. NPR's Asma Khalid reports Harris will focus on more topics later, such as the high cost of housing and groceries.
Harris is calling for the construction of 3 million new housing units to deal with the shortage in the country. And she says she'd offer tax breaks to home builders to help. She also wants to give first-time home buyers $25,000 toward a down payment and put limits on the ability of Wall Street investors to buy up rental units in bulk. Harris is trying to zero in on cutting expenses that are top of mind for voters, housing, health care, and groceries. And the price of groceries are another issue Harris is expected to focus on during her speech in North Carolina. She's calling for a federal ban on price gouging in the food sector. Her campaign specifically cites the price of meat. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Former President Donald Trump focused on the economy during his press conference yesterday at his golf club in New Jersey. He blamed Harris for the high cost of living, especially groceries, and he talked about the U.S. energy industry, including his goal to increase oil and gas drilling.
We're going to drill, baby, drill. We're going to get the energy prices down almost immediately, and we're going to close the border, and we're going to get the crooked ones out, the bad ones out.
Trump also spent time criticizing Harris. He says he is entitled to personal attacks. Trump will hold a rally tomorrow in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Ceasefire talks for Gaza will continue for a second day today in Qatar. NPR has learned from an Israeli official gaps have been narrowed in the talks. A spokesman for the Qatari mediators says they're determined to make progress. The Israeli delegation is there. Hamas did not send representatives to the talks. The group says it has already offered a counterproposal to a U.S.-backed plan. It says if Israel agrees, it's ready to implement the deal. Stocks opened mixed today amid signs of a slowdown in new home construction. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 30 points in early trading.
Home buyers are still sitting on the sidelines. Construction of new homes in the United States fell 6.8% in July, the Commerce Department reports. That's the lowest level since 2020 and worse than economists expected, as demand for new homes remains depressed. Many would-be homebuyers are still feeling priced out of the housing market, as mortgage rates and housing prices remain high. Now, home builders and would-be buyers alike are hoping for some relief from the Federal Reserve. As inflation continues to ease, the Fed is expected to start cutting interest rates in September. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 24 points. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Friday, and Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government. He's the communications director, and he joins us every Friday with an update from Monticello in the seat of county government. Good morning.
Boy, you make it sound so important.
Well, yes, it is. and so are you.
Oh, gee, thanks. All right.
What's going on? There was a legislative meeting yesterday, lots to get to. We talked about this before when you've been here, that you were the legislature was contemplating staggered terms, because currently there aren't staggered terms. And did they come to a resolution on that?
Yeah, there's going to be a public hearing on September 5th. They have decided to move forward. You actually get to be the first place where I drop this news. about exactly what they're contemplating for staggered terms. Because, of course, if we're going to have a public hearing on the 5th of September, the public needs to know what we're talking about with staggered terms. So if you just permit me a minute here to explain why we're even looking at staggered terms. Staggered terms are meaning that not all legislative positions are up for election at the same time. Currently, all nine are. So there is, in theory, the possibility that all nine legislators could be brand new to county government because voters decide they don't want to go with the incumbents anymore or the incumbents aren't running. That's never happened, but in the past several election cycles, it's every 4 years with legislators, there have been a majority of new legislators that come in, and it can be a steep learning curve. It can take quite a while for them. Usually, in my opinion, it takes about a year for them to fully get their feet underneath them. 3 months just to figure out where they are and what they've gotten themselves into. And then 6 months to really, I think, have a good understanding. And that's where we're about at now with our current crop of new legislators. So this has been of concern not only to the legislature, but to the Charter Review Commission, which meets every 10 years and will start meeting again next year to review the charter, the county's founding document. And they've, for several different iterations of recommendations, said you need to look at staggered terms. For various reasons, that hasn't happened up until now. And this legislature seems to be pretty unanimous. So here's the news, though, into how that's going to work. They are proposing, and the public will get to vote on this concept in November, that at the next election cycle, which the legislature's up for election again in 2027, there will be approximately four, maybe five positions that run for 3 years, and the rest will run for five. Now, that is that way because the state has also put forward a new law that says local elections have to happen on even-numbered years. So after 2027, we need to be complying with that law and making sure that elections happen. So that would mean that for the crop of legislators who, and I think this will be like drawing straws, drew the short straw and are doing just 3 years, they will then come up for election in 2030. And the other group will come up for election in 2032. And then it'll continue to cycle like that every couple of years. So that's what's going to be put forward. I'm putting together a fact sheet on it to explain it hopefully better than I just have, because it can be a little confusing as to how that's all going to work out.
Well, the whole point is to provide continuity so that not a whole board is going away and a whole new group of people are coming in, as you said, and then there's this public hearing for folks on the 5th.
It preserves institutional knowledge. And yes, I'm going to be promoting that public hearing on the 5th because this is going to be a substantial change to the way the legislature is voted into office. And everybody needs to be aware of this because if you're a voter in Sullivan County, you're going to be asked to say yay or nay to this idea in November. And of course, if you say nay, then we're not doing staggered terms, although we still will have to comply with the state governor's requirement, which would be a whole different situation. And I'm not going to confuse people further by talking about what we would do there.
Speaking of staggering, you can now stagger payments on delinquent property taxes. They can be paid in installments.
Nice segue. You know, I like that.
It's what I do, Dan.
That's why they pay you the big bucks, right?
So delinquent property taxes can now be paid in installments. They've made changes to the rules.
Yes, we've offered it before, but the state has changed some rules that we have to follow. And what our treasurer, Nancy Buck, really wants people to know, because she collects these taxes, is that agreements can only be made with residential properties. Now, commercial properties are no longer eligible to do installment agreements to pay delinquent property taxes. And the treasurer's office will be the arbiter of that because there are things that are called class codes that are assigned by assessors to properties. Is it residential? Is it commercial? Is it vacant? Is it occupied? Et cetera, et cetera. So if anything has a commercial class code assigned to it, it won't be eligible. However, if it's vacant residential classed land, it will be eligible. Plus, you have to owe between $500 and $30,000 in taxes. If it's less than $500 or it's more than $30,000, can't do the installment agreement. Also, no more than five parcels owned by a single individual can be put into the installment agreement program at any given time. Current taxes that are due to towns during the first 3 months of the year, January, February, and March, can't be included. And something that has always been in there, but I think is worth mentioning to people right now, village taxes cannot be paid at all via installment agreements, at least through Sullivan County. We have a full list of frequently asked questions on the treasurer's webpage on the county website if you want more info, or just give them a call, 807-0200. That's 845-807-0200. They will answer your question. They live for this kind of thing, and they may hate me for saying this, but I really do think they love interacting with the public. As long as you're polite and courteous, I know with taxes sometimes it's hard to be, but they want to help. As much as the law allows, including on installment payments.
One of the other issues we've been talking about during your visits on Fridays is the ethics board. There's an update on the ethics board or the ethics law, but basically that update is they're sort of postponing action. What's going on there?
Right. They got very, very close yesterday to updating the ethics board law. And we had talked about sort of an either-or situation of were they going to continue with the current ethics board or were they going to route it all outside to an outside attorney. It seems like they're going for a hybrid where in the legislature's discretion, they can either keep a particular case, it's on a case-by-case basis, can go with the ethics board or goes to an outside independent firm that would investigate. Be paid by the county to do so. However, at the last minute, some legislators decided, you know what, we should have a clause in this new ethics board law update that automatically basically routes it to an outside agency if it involves a legislator, if the ethics committee does, because the legislature should not be making a decision about itself when it comes to ethics like that. And so that seems to have garnered widespread acceptance with legislators. So, we've bumped it now to September where there'll be another brief public hearing. The extra language will be added and then I anticipate they'll pass it, but it does not seem that it will spell the end of the locally appointed ethics board. It will just be on a case by case basis how they are involved.
Some things they did agree on though, they've agreed to continue funding SUNY Sullivan's budget.
$4.25 million. I think SUNY Sullivan asked for $4.5 million, but the legislature is like, at this point, we want to remain conservative with what we're doing and really would like the state to kick in. They're supposed to, it's supposed to be a third county supported, a third tuition supported, and a third state supported. Well, guess which one of those three is not living up to its bargain and never has for any of the community colleges across the state and just doesn't seem to ever gain any traction. So we continue to advocate for it. So does the college. But in the meantime, though, the college knows we're there for them if they got into a really big financial bind anyway. We really support them. They're the jewel of Sullivan County.
That's for this coming school year?
Yep, this coming school year, which will be starting, I can't believe it, in just a few weeks. Yep. So,
if you're just joining us, we're talking to Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update. A few positions appointed or folks named to a couple of different positions that have been opened. We've got management and budget commissioner, new budget director, and a new LDC board member for Sunset Lake. Tell us about those.
Mm-hmm. Poor Jim Galligan, he's the only one that isn't paid. He has to, he has volunteered to serve on the Sunset Lake Local Development Corporation, which was agreed to by the legislature yesterday. This is the LDC, as it's called, that oversees the care center, actually owns the property there. Sullivan County itself continues to be the operator and also has some oversight of the LDC itself. And Jim is a former administrator of the care center. So he came highly recommended. He actually volunteered himself. He did not need to be pulled kicking and screaming into this volunteer position because, you know, it's a very controversial, volatile topic as to what to do with the care center. And he's going to be part of this group. I believe it's five who are involved with it and meet. They're trying to meet on a monthly basis. They haven't met recently because they had too many vacancies, but now we're resolving that, and I think they'll be meeting next month. And then we have a new management and budget commissioner, Anna Marie Novello, who people have known as one of our senior budget analysts. We all know her in inside the county because she is the one that helps oversee payroll. So everyone pays attention to that. And then Lou Anderson is going to be the budget director These are people who have worked with us for many years. I'll be putting out a press release about them, but the county is in very good hands with them. They replaced the retiring budget director, Janet Young.
All right. And I want to remind folks about some traffic things that are going on. County Route 115 closed for 3 weeks.
Yes, it's closed now. And we've had some issues with truck traffic. This is really why I wanted to mention it for all the truckers that are listening in right now. While the cars that are welcome to come down County Road 115 and then they'll take a short little detour that puts them right back out on Route 52. Trucks, we can't put them on the back road that is the detour right now. So if you are coming down 17B and you see that road closed ahead on County Route 115, don't turn onto 115. Stay on 17B to Fosterdale. Hang a left onto 52, which will take you through Lake Huntington, because otherwise we're going to have to turn you around if you come down 115, and it's not a great place to turn around.
That's closed for 3 weeks, again, longer
time. To replace a bridge.
Right. And then the legislature county is going to be doing that emergency services youth academy again next year.
Yeah, this is really great news. I just wanted to say we've already picked dates. It'll be again in, I think, the last week of July of next year. We had such a success with this week-long emergency services youth academy open to youth ages 14 to 16 who live in Sullivan County. We started with just 7. I have a feeling from all the photos we've put out, and we're going to be doing a promo video of all the best things that happened there, all the coolest things, that we are going to get quite a few more young people who now want to be involved because they know this is a really fun, awesome way to spend your summer. It involves helicopters, ambulances, drones, a Stokes basket, which I didn't even know what that was, but that's how they get you out of the woods and keep you immobile or raise you up. We set off flares and like water bomb things to show how our bomb disposal units at the state police work. For us adults, we were like, oh my gosh, if we had had this as a teen, I would have tried to come every year. But the most important part of it was that I think every kid who is involved now either wants to volunteer or pursue a career in emergency response. That is where we're really making an impact.
Dan Hoost is the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. We're going to let you go a little early today to enjoy your lovely Friday afternoon, Friday morning.
All right. You too, Tim. Get some rest. You've been busy the past day.
Are you saying I look tired?
No, I'm saying you are.
And you are always right, sir. Thank you so much. We'll take a break and more Radio Chatskill after this.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. On Saturday, the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational... that's coming up next. After this, we've got a different segment first. On Sunday, Japanese artist and activist Yasuo Tanaka will speak about her work as a peace and fervent anti-nuclear advocate at the Narrowsburg Union. Her visit coincides with the somber dates in the shared history of Japan, United States of America, and the world. She spoke to culture reporter Valerie Manzi.
Welcome, Yasuo, to Radio Chatskill. And we're here to talk about an upcoming event that will be happening this Sunday at the Narrowsburg Union at 10:15. It's sponsored by the Upper Delaware Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. First of all, let me ask you, what motivated you to do this work?
My hometown was hit by the radiation, after the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster. And it became a candidate site for the nuclear disposal facility. So I began researching nuclear issues. Around this time, I learned that the Manhattan Project, which was created to develop and manufacture atomic bombs, had begun in New York City. Its facilities were in my neighborhood. It was meaningful for me that I, who was born in Japan, the atomic bomb country, was living here. My motivation is to realize a peace world without nuclear weapon, beginning in New York City, the birthplace of nuclear development.
So you have a personal and direct experience in your creating of this project. Who participated in the project, and where and how was it created?
Teens and preteens students participated in this project in an after-school program at the Manhattanville Community Center, located near the Nash Garage building, which provided the platform for Manhattan Project Military Industrial Academic Complex.
What type of artwork was included?
The students learned about the Manhattan Project and the nuclear disasters, made hand-bound books with collages and text expressing their impressions of their topic, and created a map with the description of Manhattan Project related location in New York City. They also made origami works for peace and health.
And what do you hope this project will evoke?
In this project, students learned and were able to share with others that the United States, which manufactures nuclear weapons, is itself contaminated by radiation. I hope these students will become interested in environmental issues and do their own research to develop their healthy and peaceful minds.
How long did this project take?
I had three grants, creative writing grants, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and different years. And 2019, I teach Manhattan Project and made a book this year. And 2022, I had an origami project and called Peace and Harmony. And we made the medicine ball called Kusudama and also paper crane. And we had a wish exception. And so we had this project. And also 2023, and we made the map about Manhattan Project relating facility in New York City. So students research and wrote the description. And so that I did a different year and spring and summertime. Yes.
And most of this work will be seen on Sunday. And before we go, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background here and in Japan, as well as your artistic practice.
My home country, Tochigi Prefecture, is the birthplace of environmental activist, ecologist, Shozo Tanaka. Japan's first major pollution disaster, the Ashio copper mine incident, occurred in Tochigi in the 1880s.
Wow.
I learned this history as a teenager. It formed the roots of my environmental activism and education. Having spent half my life in United States, I have developed the ability to observe things objectively from a wide lens perspective. My art practice uses my creativity to work on environmental and social issues. To teach is to be taught. We learn from each other and deepen our mutual understanding. That's my goal.
Okay, and there's New York City chiming in. It's always a busy place there, as we know. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to create and complete this project. And we look forward to seeing you on Sunday, the 18th, at Narrowsburg Union at 10:15.
Thank you for interviewing me. Thank you.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that interview. We'll take a break. And when we come back, stepping back in time with a vintage baseball game. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Some are saying, well, we want to go back to the country the way it was. Susan B. Anthony gives a powerful speech. She does not want to go back. She says, from the moment that the first person was put in shackles in Africa and brought to this country, we've been at war. And this is the time to end that war. And she says, I do not want a union that is a sham.
Thank you, Susan B. Anthony. This week on the Janice Adams Show, we celebrate the Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls, Saturday at 11.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Saturday, August 24th, next Saturday, the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River is inviting the public to a 19th century baseball exhibition featuring the Mountain Athletic Club and the Elizabeth Resolutes. The free game will be at the Veterans Memorial Park in Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania. And to tell us more about it, we've got the team together. We've got the captain of the Elizabeth Resolutes, Craig Combs, the captain of the Mountain Athletic Club, their challenger, Colin Miller, and Susie Casper, park ranger from the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
All right, Susie, tell us about this match and that it's being held in honor of Zane Grey.
Well, thanks so much for having us again. Another great event coming up, and hopefully it'll be beautiful weather in Lackawaxen on the 24th. I'll let the baseball talk to Colin, but I just wanted to remind everybody that, you know, people don't realize that Zane Grey, before he was even a dentist, played baseball. He loved, absolutely loved playing baseball where he grew up in Zanesville, Ohio. You know, he played pickup games all over, and at the age of 14, he was the only boy who could throw a curveball. And so as he grew and progressed in his baseball career, he actually was scouted by many schools throughout, you know, before he was actually college-aged. One game that he played, there were scouts from the University of Pennsylvania there, scouts from Ohio Wesleyan University, Vanderbilt, University of Michigan, and then he was eventually offered a scholarship at the University of Pennsylvania, where he actually then ended up studying dentistry. Following in his father's footsteps, unfortunately, he didn't like dentistry, and he really focused more on the baseball aspect of it. And he did have an excellent curveball, and he probably would have gone professional had they not moved the pitcher's mound back about 5 feet. We can blame Cy Young for that one. And unfortunately, Zane Grey's kind of baseball career went, you know, from there. And then the rest is history, because he came up to Lackawaxen and loved the river, loved writing, and met his wife here. And then he would actually go on to write many books about baseball as well, because he had such a passion for it, the redheaded outfielder, the shortstop, and the young pitcher. So the reason we're doing this game is because Zane Grey loved baseball. And, of course, these two amazing baseball clubs they can tell us all about the history of baseball, and we can kind of relive a little bit of that history right here in Lackawaxen.
And, yeah, I want to talk to Colin and to Craig about the tradition of vintage baseball. The Mountain Athletic Club, Colin, is continuing a Fleshman's Field tradition since 1895?
Correct. Yeah, we were founded in the then Griffin's Corners, New York, in 1895 when the Fleischman's boys, the heirs to the Fleischman's throne, were 24 and 18 years old at the time, and they had a vacation estate where they could seek respite from the hot summers in Cincinnati. And they actually owned 168 acres and several palatial estates on that land. And when the boys got old enough, Cincinnati was very popular. Baseball was huge in Cincinnati. And they sought to make a better field to be able to play. And prior to the creation of that field, they were just kind of using some whatever patch of ground they could find. And there's actually some old newspaper clippings that talk about where you would hit the ball in any direction, it would be a home run, because they were playing on these hard scrabble diamonds, probably on sloped land. So they bought a piece of land in the valley bottom along the Bushkill Stream. And that's still where we play our games today. Back in 2020, we listed it on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's now called the Mack Grounds at Fleischman's Park.
19th century baseball is something that's happening all over the country. There are clubs all over. Craig, your Elizabeth Resolute's team is, I would say, relatively new to the tradition. You guys are in your 25th season.
Correct. We're in our 25th season of reconstruction, but the Elizabeth Resolutes actually were an amateur club that played from 1866 to 1878 and won the New Jersey amateur championships in 1870, which is the rules that our club plays by.
And are there different rule differences between modern baseball and 19th century baseball? Can you kind of briefly tell us some of the rules and customs that are different and unusual?
Sure. Yeah, there are a lot of differences. So the biggest one that people find is that you cannot overrun first base before 1871, I believe. So a lot of the clubs around in this program, they tend to play 1864 baseball, 1865. So you're not able to run past first base. The other big one is it is underhand pitching. And the one that I guess most people notice first is we play without baseball gloves.
Oh, wow.
Barehanded.
You guys are serious about it.
Yes, we are.
And, Colin, I want to ask you to, and also Craig, too, if you want to chime in about just the tradition of this national pastime we all kind of know. But, you know, these have been going on, these games, with different rules, as we've seen, based on location and evolution for well over 200 years.
Yeah, that's right. We actually have some printings in Delaware County that date back to 1825. Where there was a game held in the town of Hamden, which next year is going to celebrate its bicentennial. So that obviously predates the, quote, invention of baseball by Abner Doubleday by about 14 years. So baseball, the first record of baseball being played in America that we have now is in 1796 in a Pittsfield, Massachusetts town record. So baseball has been going on for a very long time, over 200 years. So the vintage community, so what we define as vintage baseball is predominantly all 19th century style baseball. I mean, you could buy a pair of Jordache jeans from the 80s and people call it vintage clothing, but we are certainly going back to the 19th century to showcase what we do. And actually yesterday we just played a double day field in Cooperstown, and we actually did an exhibition from 1857 to 1895 in about 2 hours. And we just showcased how the rules evolved throughout those years. And it was really fascinating. And there's always tons of questions. And we love that, because what we do is probably equally part history and education, part sport and part theater. And if you have all three parts working in tandem, it's an absolutely amazing event. And we've done this before down in Lackawaxen, we had a great crowd. Susie and the Park Service did a fantastic job promoting the event, and we're really looking forward to this.
If you check out the website for both of the teams, you'll see that they're outfitted in vintage uniforms. It doesn't appear as if anyone is wearing Jordache jeans. And Susie, you're inviting folks, to kids especially, to wear their favorite baseball or softball uniforms to show their team spirit during this event coming up on the 24th.
Yeah, of course. And I definitely think that's great, you know, and bring that glove because you never know if you're going to catch a stray ball. I also want to remind folks that we have the Zane Grey's West Society has produced a Zane Grey baseball trading card that highlights his pitching and his outfielding career. Of course, has all his batting stats on there. So when you come to the game, visit with them and pick up a free baseball card, too.
All right, that's coming up on the 24th at Lackawaxen, the vintage baseball game featuring the Elizabeth Resolutes and the Mountain Athletic Club there at Veterans Memorial Park in Lackawaxen. You can get more information by calling the Zane Grey Museum or visiting nps.gov. Thank you guys so much, and have a great game.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. That was great.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Woodstock's 55th anniversary. We'll find out about the celebrations unfolding this weekend with Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Selected Shorts, we go from John Wayne to John Deere with fiction about what the West once was and what the West is today. I'm Meg Wolitzer. Saddle up and come along.
Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Chatskill. It's the 55th anniversary of the 1969 Woodstock Festival this weekend. It became one of the most iconic music festivals that defined a generation and became a symbol of peace, love, and so much more. Joining us now is Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods to tell us what's happening this weekend. Dr. Neil, I guess things started a little earlier this week, actually.
Well, yeah, we've had Henry Dilts here all this week. We were trying to work out a program. Henry Dilts is up in Woodstock, New York, today and tomorrow, but was here yesterday. Well, he's been here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, here at the site. He will be back on Sunday. I'll talk about that in a minute, but I'm standing at the monument right now, which is kind of crazy here today.
Yeah, we can hear folks in the background. That's really cool.
Yeah, I would say the 55th anniversary started yesterday on the 15th. The 16th, the second day of the festival, when, you know, in 1969, the majority of people came on Saturday, the 16th. Today at the monument, I'm going to say there's probably 50 to 60 people down here already this morning. And John Cain, author of Pilgrims of Progress, is down here. He's going to be doing a book signing up in the museum today, 11 to 3. I saw Paul Dittmer running around here. Paul Dittmer has been like an avocational historian of Woodstock for many years, collecting oral histories all around the country, just like what the museum does. And when I say that, the Museum of Bethel Woods is at the monument today doing a pop-up, an oral history pop-up. People who attended Woodstock on these anniversaries, like the 55th anniversary, often show up on their pilgrimage. I think we had 7 people yesterday that told a story on camera about, you know, coming back. Many of them, this is their first time coming on pilgrimage 55 years later. It's been, I don't know, amazing 2 days. I think these, like, 55 is a significant number. So it's that kind of time when, you know, I think people are making a trip back.
Yeah, and there's that pilgrimage you're talking about with John Cain today, 11 to 3 at the museum lobby, Pilgrims of Woodstock. And then you mentioned the oral history part of it. You're having an oral history pop-up at the Conneaugh Lake Farmers Market on Saturday, starting at 10 to 3. And we talked about this. We've talked about this with you before. It's part of your oral history initiative. And yesterday we were able to include some of that specifically as it related to the mud of Woodstock when we played your conversation with Jason Dole about the all of the mud. Yeah. But you're looking for folks to tell their story of Woodstock. Talk a little bit about the oral history initiative and what's going on tomorrow.
Yeah. So this is kind of, again, a back-to-back oral history pop-ups, one at the Monument today, one at Conneaugga Lake Farmers Market tomorrow. The one at Conneaugga Lake Farmers Market is specifically aligned with the unveiling of the Woodstock marker at Conneaugga Lake Park, which has been placed there by the Borschtfeldt Marker Project. So the partnership with the Borschtfeldt Marker Project and the Borschtfeldt Museum is a grant-funded project through IMLS that we will be doing from in 2025, throughout the year 2025. Kind of begins tomorrow at Conneaugga Lake Farmers Market, and it's really an effort to collect local stories. So almost everywhere I go in the county, like it, somebody will say, oh, well, my grandmother made sandwiches, or, you know, I was in junior high school. We made 3,000 sandwiches, and somebody hung, my junior high school teacher held me by the belt out of a helicopter, and I threw sandwiches out to the Woodstock crowd. But those, we've not systematically or collected those stories into a collection that will be preserved forever. The fifth year of our five-year oral history initiative is really devoted to getting the local stories. It's really important, even if somebody just comes and tells a story for 5 minutes, right? Just kind of tells their local story, that the local stories are saved and are seen as valuable as like the stories of attendees that we go across the country collecting. Because if they're not collected now, again, there's going to be a time when they're lost, and like that local story is just lost. It floated out on the air at a party and was never recorded for to be preserved for history.
Yeah. That's happening tomorrow, Conneaugga Lake Farmers Market. Folks can sit down with museum curators like yourself, share your stories. Also tomorrow, Bill Hanley and John Kane, The Last Seat in the House, the story of Hanley Sound in the museum lobby. Folks can meet Bill Hanley, the creator of the Woodstock sound system, which is really cool.
I had dinner with Bill last night. He's here. Like, they're going to do a book signing tomorrow. But, you know, one of his speakers is on display, one of the original Woodstock speakers on display in the basement. It's not very often like that you get an opportunity to meet some of the icons that made the festival happen in 1969. And we really, on these kind of anniversary weeks, try to make that happen, make, you know, programs and opportunities. So you can get a book signed from Bill Hanley. You can come talk to him about sound. You can interact and engage with kind of the icons of festivals, right? He's on the ground floor of building festivals.
Well, and when you think about those legendary performances from Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin or The Who or others, you know, he's the guy that helped that sound sound so cool and good.
The reality is we wouldn't be talking about the festival 55 years later had Bill Hanley not designed and made a speaker to cover, like, to get the sound of Jimi Hendrix out to 50,000, you know, 100,000 people. Yeah. No one would remember the Who's performance at 5 o'clock in the morning if they didn't hear it.
Right.
Right. Could barely see it. They can't hear it. So I think that end of the creation of this sound system, right, is one of the things that made this happen.
Made it so iconic as well. Bill Hanley is there with John Kane tomorrow at 11. Tomorrow, folks can take golf tours of the grounds. Also, Scott Parker of the Woodstock-themed podcast Keep the Dream Flowing will be on site at 4 in the special exhibit gallery to keep the dream flowing, talking to folks about the coolest parts of keeping Woodstock alive and then featuring them on the Keep the Dream Flowing podcast.
Yeah, there's a lot going on tomorrow. Yeah. We've opened a new, what we call the Main Gate Tour. We've just opened phase two of a path, the gentle path through the Bendy Woods, and we're doing a special price tour on a golf cart. We're doing those every hour on the hour tomorrow. And then again, we're kind of capping our day with a podcast, but the podcast is really a roundtable session with a bunch of people that were at the festival talking about their experience at the festival. It should be really fun. It's a fun way to end the 55th anniversary.
Yeah, and then on Sunday there's that cool event I want to make sure we get to before we go. Our House, the music of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and then also that's with a dinner as well.
Yeah, so if you're not worn out by everything else, yes, on Sunday we're doing an event gallery performance. We're doing a matinee at 3 o'clock, and then there's a sold out show at 8 o'clock. And this is a band that's not really a tribute band. It is a band of performers that toured with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and then family members as well. And there will be a multimedia presentation. Henry Diltz will be back for that presentation and doing that on stage as part of this extravaganza of music.
Yeah, and there's more information about everything that's going on this weekend at the BethelWoodsCenter.org website. That's Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods. He's talking to us live on the iconic grounds of the festival right there by the marker. Dr. Neil, thank you so much, and hopefully you won't be worn out by the end. Have fun.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, the String Queens, Harmony in the Woods. We'll talk to them next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Cassie from Rare Pear Radio, playing you the fruit of all things sweet, Fridays 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., mostly female artists, from rock, funk, punk, pop, and more. All rare, only on WJFF Radio Catskill.
Like a radio station, man. Just turn it on.
Donna Fellenberg here, and on Catskill Character this week, my guests are Woodstock and pop icon Rona Elliott, one of the 13 original staff at Woodstock, and Dan Carlson, Dio Santiago, and Nancy, who have stories about being at the festival or living nearby. Fascinating history. Don't miss it this Saturday on Catskill Character at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. The String Queens are a trio of musicians that translate pop hits into their own language using violin, viola, and cello. These classically trained virtuosos have brought their stunning and diverse lineup of popular and classical songs on national stages like the Kennedy Center and Carnegie Hall. They'll be performing at Harmony in the Woods in Hawley on Sunday, August 18th at 6th. Joining us now on the phone is one of the String Queens, Kendall Isidore, who plays violin. Kendall, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, good. How are you? Thanks for being here.
I'm doing great. Thank you for having us.
Well, tell us about the origins of the String Queens. I mentioned, you know, your trio of musicians who translate pop songs. How did this come about from your, you know, classical training into this great version of bringing music to folks?
Yes, well, of course, music brought us together. And actually, Dawn and Elise, our violist and our cellist, respectively, were the first two to meet. So they actually were playing together in a symphony called Soulful Symphony at the time. This was closer to 15 or so years ago. Dawn was a student at Juilliard. And so the symphony itself was a combination of New York City-based and Baltimore, D.C., Maryland, Virginia-based musicians. And so Dawn would come down every so often to perform with that symphony. And Dawn and Elise were both the principals of their section, first chair viola, first chair cello. And so in sitting by one another, they developed a great friendship and a great admiration for one another's playing, truly. And then from there, Elise and I sort of met separately, completely independently of that. I later joined Symphony, but that was much later. Elise and I met on the D.C. jazz gig scene, honestly. A lot of times we would just get paired together to perform for different cocktail receptions and fundraisers and things like that. But we wouldn't know what the music was. We would just show up together having never rehearsed, and we just hit it off immediately, both socially, musically, and otherwise. And then the first time the three of us played together for the first time was because I forgot to mention how Dawn and I met. Dawn and I met through her husband. Uh-huh. It's the funniest thing, very short story. Her husband is an English teacher, and I started off as a science teacher. Well, we taught in the same school, literally two doors down from one another. And during our planning period, I remember him coming in saying, "Kendall, like, how's your day going?" I'm like, "It's going okay, but I can't find a violist for an upcoming wedding gig." He goes, "Well, my wife plays viola." And I'm like, "Brian, who's a huge jokester, Don's husband." I'm like, "Yeah, right. Like, sure she does." He's like, no, like, she went to Juilliard. She just finished her master's from Juilliard. Like, you really should give her a call." And I'm like, "Oh, Juilliard, rings bells, ding, ding, ding. Please give me her number. I'm going to go ahead and give her a call." I gave her a call. We carpooled to that wedding gig, and we just developed a sisterhood and a friendship almost immediately. Of course, we played a great gig, and then we kind of moved on. And then when Dawn was the person who had to hire for a wedding gig, she decided to hire a trio. That was the very first time that the three of us played together, was for Dawn's wedding trio gig. We didn't have time to rehearse, as is pretty typical, right? We were playing the same standard wedding repertoire. And so Dawn said, "You know what, we'll just rehearse at my child's first birthday party. We don't have time, so, like, just bring your instruments to the party. We'll play Sesame Street theme song. We'll play Little Einstein theme song, Twinkle Twinkle. We'll do the whole bit, and that'll give us a chance to play together." Tim, we never played together because we were just having so much fun.
Yeah.
And we played the gig the next day, and we noticed even playing Mozart, Brahms, Handel, Bach, we played it with soul, and we knew then we have to make this a real thing. Shortly after that, we had a meeting. We brought our repertoire ideas. We brought our name ideas, and we emerged from that meeting as the String Queen.
Well, and talk about that, that bringing that quality of fun to classical music. It's not necessarily something people associate with it, and also bringing it a little more broadly to folks by translating, you know, popular songs into more classical arrangements.
Absolutely. I think, you know, for so long, classical music, you know, the concert halls, symphony halls, you know, some folks think that those are only for certain types of folks, only for certain types of people. But really, it's just music. No matter the genre, no matter the category, how we want to organize the music, it's just music. And so for us, we endeavored to play music that was part of our soundtrack to our lives, our upbringing. What did we listen to on the way to school? What were the songs that were ringing through the walls and the, you know, of our homes? During Saturday morning cleaning, doing your chores. I mean, the music that we play, Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, the Beatles, spirituals, gospel, pop, as you mentioned, all of this music is soulful music, and it's the music that called out to us. However, when we decided on what we wanted to play, and we sort of looked out to musical libraries to see what music already existed in written form, which as classical musicians, we're used to being trained to read, right? We're trained to stick to the page, however the composer intended it to be, play that and execute it that way. But we wanted to play things like Anita Baker, right? Or, you know, Lauryn Hill, all the way to even jazz, right? For trio, this music didn't exist. And when we wanted to play Eleanor Rigby, it may have existed in quartet form. But everything that people hear from the three albums we recorded, it's an original sound. It's an orchestral sound. We're constantly playing double stops because there are only three of us. However, we want this full sound of like six to eight people. We want that for people to be able to hear that. And so it's a very multifaceted purpose and process when we sit down to arrange and decide on a concert set list. But it is what breaks that barrier between classical music and everyone else. The music we choose to play welcomes everyone into the concert hall or the jazz club or a nice day in the park, right? Yeah. And it brings a little more love to and brightness and sunshine to this society and our world that we live in. And we cannot get enough love, especially today.
Education also important to what you guys do. We were meant to be joined by the other two String Queens, but they're in school. Are they teaching the classical right now?
So I'll tell you what we all do. So our cellist, Elise, she actually was just brought on to my school where I work as a high school administrator. She was just brought on to take over the orchestra program at a private high school in Maryland where we've now both worked. Dawn moved from being a longtime middle school orchestra director to being an elementary music teacher, and now she's an instructional coach. So she facilitates coaching for the arts teachers in her school, and now she has now been added to coaching math, all the math teachers in her school. So again, multifaceted. And then myself, I moved from being a science teacher at the middle school level to an orchestra director at the middle school level to a vice principal, and then I decided to leave it all behind to join this high school I just mentioned, where Elise will be, as the director of enrollment and admissions at that school. But I still very much support and work in fine arts. And now that Elise is going to be at my school, we're going to be jamming out in that orchestra classroom. So we're really, really excited. And we also teach private lessons. So, and we teach other music teachers across the country on how to just what our best practices are and what we've learned from the field. So teaching and performing will always go hand in hand, side by side for the string queens.
Oh, those are some lucky kids to have you guys teaching them. That's great.
We're lucky too.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about representation as well. Your three African-American women playing in classical music. Also, presentation. If you go to the website, thestringqueens.com, go to the bio page and check out how fierce these ladies look. Is that part of the message that you bring along as well? Is that intentional?
Yeah, I would say it's intentional. It really even starts from the name, right? Queens, right?
Yeah.
The representation as royalty and regality is very important to us. But again, it doesn't just go with the performing. Like when I first started teaching an orchestra, you know, we have so many students sometimes. And in the beginning of the year, you're trying to remember everyone's name and you may say honey or baby. But a lot of times I would say queen or king or something like that, that kind of exudes royalty when I couldn't remember their name or just to remind them of who they are and how I see them. And so when we think about the string queens, the music we play, how we represent ourselves, right? Even the aesthetic, right? How we choose to not just stick to black, all black, which is the typical orchestral attire, right? We go out to bright colors, right? Feathers, you know, sequins, you know, we really want to make sure that people see a different face for classical music. We've seen this traditional European monolithic face or representation of this music, but there's so many people, you know, who play stringed instruments. Now, we make up as black women and just black string players, less than 2% of black string players or black string players in the world are black.
Mm-hmm.
And so we take upon that mantle with pride because our blackness and our heritage is the fabric of who we come from and what we come from. And so even in the style that we play, you know, it's very common to come to a string queen's concert and every three or four or five songs or so, you may hear us just tuning a little bit, which is like, often frowned upon during an orchestra concert, but the style that we play, we're literally banging on the instruments. We're literally pouring our bodies and our souls and everything we have into the instruments and bending the strings in such a way that's not the typical way that these instruments are to be played. But even that tells a story that we can break these barriers. We can showcase, you know, the boundaries that, you know, we don't have to be in a box. We get to experience all genres of music through stringed instruments and then share that with the world. Our mission is to create musical experiences for diverse audiences and to inspire those audiences to love, hope, feel, and imagine. If we have gotten our audiences to get any inspiration in those four areas, then we feel we've done our job, no matter what the encounter is or where we are.
Wow, such a great mission. Coming off of three nights in New York City, I understand. And then,
so much fun.
Yeah, good. And you're going to bring that fun to Harmony in the Woods this Sunday at 6. String Queens performing at Harmony in the Woods. There's more information about that at harmonyinthewoods.org. We've been talking to Kendall Isidore from the String Queens. Thank you so much for joining us and for bringing this joy to classical music for what you do and the mission and the education, all of it. That's great.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you for having us. We're so excited and we'll see you all on Sunday.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to wrap it up here for this edition of Radio Chatskill. But before we go, earlier this week, you may have heard us announce that there was a lost dog in our area, Monty. Well, good news. They found Monty. And why? Because we made the announcement on Radio Catskill. Neighbors came out along Knickerbocker Road and White Road, Lake Road, to help search for hours for Monty. The owners, Pat and Eric, want to thank their kind neighbors, Danielle Stone, Florian Storch, Jacqueline and Stephen Rennert, Susan and Mark Jaffe of Snowdance Farm, Bonnie and Joe Marty, Debbie and Joe, Steve Brienza, and a huge thank to Eva and her son, Lauren, who searched for hours until 2 in the morning and the next day and pulled Monty out of the mud and brambles. They're very grateful to all, and we're so glad Monty's back, and we're so glad you were listening. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The hundreds of years, the British Navy and the British Army forced young men to serve, sometimes dragging them from their beds and from their families. The press gang took them. Next time on the Wagaloo Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, on Radio Catskill, we hear songs about the press gang. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill. Today's weather, intervals of clouds and sunshine, some wildfire smoke will cause the sky to be hazy, high 83. Cloudy with a shower in spots late tonight, a low of 62, and then some rain on the weekend. Rain, some of it heavy, and thunderstorms will affect our area on Sunday, especially. Some of those will be slow-moving and bringing heavy rain.